Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This piece was brought to you by Roberta's, robertaspizza.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Happy Thursday. This is the HRN Happy Hour. We have a packed studio and a packed show today. Really excited to get rolling. I hope everybody's had a great week. We missed you. So we're back. I'm going to roll around and introduce everybody who's here today. My name's Katie Mosman-Wadler. I'm the Executive Director of Heritage Radio Network. My very generous sound guy, engineer in the booth, is David Tadashore. Thank you. I think he got more applause than I did. To my right, we have Emily Pontecorvo, who produced this week's episode. Hi, Emily.
Hello.
And beside Emily is Kat Johnson, our communications director.
Hey, everybody.
We are also honored to have in studio with us today Patrick Martins, founder of Heritage Radio Network.
Hello.
That's exactly what he sounds like in real life. And our very, very special guest today is Abe Shaw. He's the founder of Eating Tools, which sells unique and handmade eating and cooking tools from artists and designers worldwide. Based right here in Brooklyn and longtime supporter of Heritage Radio Network. Thank you, Abe, and hi.
Happy, happy hour. Good to be here.
Happy, happy hour to you. And what a happy, happy hour it is. So what did everybody do this week before we get into the highlights? Kat, what was your week like?
I had a really fun Sunday night. I went to KCBC in Bushwick, and we were just walking by, did not have plans to go, and we see a sign that says chamber music tonight. And I was like, what is going on? They had a chamber orchestra playing a set, and they ended with Rhapsody in Blue, and then the brewery also brewed a beer called Rhapsody in Brew. And it was like, I never thought that beer and orchestra music would go so well together. But it was just like a really like nice, chill way to spend a Sunday night.
Nice.
Yeah.
Cool. Patrick, how about you?
I got arrested in Missouri and cuffed.
You topped mine.
So if you get, like, I guess my car got tickets, you know, from all those kind of videos that catch you. But then how do they know I was the one driving? Because many people drive a car. And then it made me wonder, if I'm very high on points, how come our insurance is going up? Anne is on the insurance. So how could one person with low points be on the insurance, even though their significant other, their husband or kid or whatever, has a lot of points and isn't on the insurance? And so the insurance stays low, but it's driven by a high-risk driver. So everything is crazy. I shouldn't have gotten the point. It was a driver's assessment fee. That's what got me, which is an arbitrary fee they add on separate from tickets if you have X amount of points. Very frustrating, but I'm all right. I survived my hour in prison.
Rebel, rebel.
It was terrible.
You're hardened. You
seem the more... men were very nice to me there, thank God.
So nice, I bet.
Yeah.
The nicest.
I'm standing, by the way, in studio.
Uh-huh. Thanks for that. Great. Abe, I hope your weekend was better.
It was good. My week has been defined by a wedding that I went to this weekend.
Oh, nice.
In North Carolina, where it was about as cold as it is here, but a very good friend's wedding, good food, good drink. Gave me an opportunity to celebrate and see Paddy's Day on Friday, which I don't usually do, but when you're out of town celebrating with friends, it worked out well.
Nice.
Aww. Wow, Dave.
I'll take that.
Dave, how about you? You on the mic?
What did I do this weekend? I don't even know.
You worked.
Next.
Sound effect.
We'll talk about what you did when we get to the highlights from the show. Emily?
I had
didn't do much this weekend, but last week I was in Portland, Maine. I was doing a radio workshop up there at the Salt Institute, which is a documentary school. And I, on Friday, didn't get to eat anything in Maine all week, but on Friday I got to go to Eventide, which they were just nominated for a James Beard Award.
Wait, you didn't eat all week?
Just nothing special. Nothing.
Everything in Portland is special.
But Eventide is specialer.
Eventide was special. I had a very special lobster roll there, and that was a highlight.
Oh, yeah. Can you tell us about that lobster roll? I want everyone to know about it.
Oh, my God. Okay, I think it's on a potato bun, and it's, like, on some other kind of bun, and it's a brown butter lobster roll. They do butter, not mayonnaise.
Yeah.
I don't know what else to say. It was delicious.
It's really bomb. It's like a steam bun.
Do people in the Florida Keys propose that their lobsters are better than Maine lobsters? Because, I mean, shouldn't there be a competition?
No, there is no competition.
I've never heard Florida try to claim that.
I know, but they should.
Maine lobster is inferior.
It has no hands. You can't eat the hands. You just eat the tail on the Florida one.
Which is, like, not the best part. It's the worst part.
Is it? Is that true? Is the claw considered tastier than the tail?
Well, do you want to know my secret? Mm-hmm. I love the claw, but the best part is the arm that, like, leads up to the claw. So, like, on a Maine lobster, you have a lot of, like, elbow, and that's the sweetest and tenderest.
Interesting.
Meat. Mm. And the little tail fins, but they're really tiny. You have to be really gentle.
Oh, tiny hands.
Tiny hands. All right. So that seems like a pretty exciting week all around. I didn't do a whole lot, but I did take my puppy to Brighton Beach this weekend, which was awesome. Hung out with family, played cards with friends, pretty low-key. So we did have a lot going on the radio last week. On Magnifico Radio, we heard about fashion's effect on the ocean because it was, in fact, World Water Day.
Yesterday.
Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so I think a lot of us are familiar with the campaign to ban microbeads because of the terrible effect they have on our oceans. So Kate Black had Steve Wilson on her show, and he was a big part of that.
It's Steve.
Okay.
Not a typo.
Steve? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, he was part of the campaign to ban the microbeads, and now his next campaign is around microfibers. And, you know, these are the fibers that come off of your clothes and the wash, and they, the same way that microbeads do, they end up in our oceans. So listen to the latest episode of Magnifico Radio about that. And then on the same trend of water, Katie Kiefer welcomed Bill Stowe, the CEO of the Des Moines Water Works, and she talks about the attempt for the Des Moines Water Works to sue for the drainage areas upriver from them who were polluting their water, and unfortunately the Supreme Court ruled against the local utility in that case. But it's just, these were two really great shows to listen to on World Water Day, and really, you know, be aware that water is not just something we should take for granted.
It is, like, the build is the biggest issue of the future, right? Lack of water.
Yeah.
And that's really intimately tied into our food and agriculture system as well. So big topic for HRN. We have so many of these things on our calendar where we have, like, World French Bread Day and International Ham Sandwich Day and a lot of these, like, more celebratory days. But World Water Day, you know, while it is kind of a holiday, it's something that we can be taking really seriously and using to kind of guide our coverage around, like, pretty serious world issues too. So not all the world something days are for
some are very
total
niche.
Celebration, but
yeah. But you can't really have any of them without water.
But we can also take a day to celebrate water.
Yeah.
We also, speaking of celebrating, we sent out a big email today highlighting kind of the latest buzz around HRN. And so in that, we got to shout out Snacky Tunes. They just got honored with an Evangelist Award at the Taste Awards in LA. That was really cool. And that goes out to people who are not only promoting themselves and their own podcasts and radio shows, but also really being ambassadors and helping other shows get promoted and just generating goodwill around an entire community of content producers. So that was really great to see.
really excited for those guys.
Those guys were one of the firsts.
They're, wow, they're still the OG, the OG Bresnitz twins.
Mm-hmm. They used to be bringing in like 20, 30 people into this little studio.
I don't believe that.
Every Sunday. Every Sunday.
That sounds like fake news.
Uh-huh. Also, not fake news, Cooking Issues got shouted out for being the best podcast for food science nerds. That's not really news. We all knew that already. But that was in Bon Appetit, shouted out by Andrew Zimmern, which was really great.
Can I say, isn't it incriminating to like all these awards groups not to have already awarded Dave's show? I mean, it's the top of its kind in the world. I mean, I just think he should get nominated every time they do a podcast show. He needs to be awarded. I think it might be a little jealousy going on because nobody beats Dave.
It's all political, man. It's all political.
It's all political, but quality is quality. We're not political.
I mean, that's just a statement of fact. He is the top of the food, nerdy science podcasts, and everything
answers your questions.
Is there. And yeah, and that's like our most robust call-in show. So really cool.
They had a really crazy call-in show this week, right, Dave?
Actually, it was all call-ins this week, which is, I mean, they always get a lot of call-ins, but usually he'll take time out to read emails, but it was just nonstop call-ins this week, so that was cool.
Cool.
And
awesome.
A shout-out to Nastasia, who is opening Pasta Flyer, the first fast food pasta concept with Mark Ladner.
I'm so excited for that.
Awesome. Will there be Heritage Foods?
Yes, they buy from Heritage, but most importantly, it's a fast food concept where you can eat pasta in under 3 minutes, you get it, and it costs under $6.
Wow, that's cheap.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Well, we are super excited for their opening. One other shout out from the email today was the hosts of We Dig Plants, Carmen DeVito and Alice Marcus Krieg, were highlighted in Garden Collage. And they also did a nice segment about the HRN mission and like our history in general. So really cool to see. We're up in the press. So that was the buzz from the latest buzz email. And speaking of buzz, last episode that we're going to highlight from this week was episode 83 of Eating Matters, titled The Secret Life of Bees. Now you get my joke. It was a hilarious joke.
Wait for it.
So on this episode, Jenna spoke with Dr. Reese Halter about the effects of our current agricultural system on bee health, including the recent declines in bee population and its devastating repercussions, and what people can do to reverse the trend. There was also a pretty interesting piece of news last week where Cheerios was trying to call attention to the plight of bees. So there's like a few did you knows here.
Honey Nut Cheerios in particular?
Well, yeah, we'll get there. Okay. But yes. So 1 in 3 bites of food that we eat is made possible by bees and other pollinating insects. So if you don't save the bees, a third of your food is going to go away. Whole Foods has done really cool things where they like take out all the produce in the produce section that's pollinated by bees and let you see like what the world would be like. Wow, I feel like this is hitting on so many levels. And then
scary bees.
Abe's swatting his head.
The really scary thing is in 2015 alone, 42% of bee colonies in the U.S. collapsed. So colony collapse disorder is happening around the world. A number of factors involved, including parasites and pesticides and habitat loss. So General Mills temporarily removed Buzz the bee, the mascot of Honey Nut Cheerios, from the boxes. And his outline has been just replaced with like a white ghost figure. They're doing a campaign called hashtag Bring Back the Bees. And this is really awesome that they're generating awareness around the topic. And you know, millions of people are going to see those boxes and hopefully contemplate for a minute that the bee is missing.
That actually makes this Onion article, the Onion headline, not that funny. Swarm called off after only 12 bees show up.
Oh, that's
actually now super depressing now that, now that I hear all this reality about bees.
But the thing is, so this story takes a turn because whenever it still seems like when big companies want to like make a great statement, do something great, then like something falls short.
Right. So we read shortly after this came out, General Mills' initiative was that on their website, they could people could claim a free package of wildflower seeds that were meant to create bee-friendly habitats. And thus far, they've given away 100 million wildflower seeds. And that was their goal. Sorry. Their goal was to give away 100 million, and they've so far sent out more than 1.5 billion seeds. which is cool. But then all of a sudden, all these bee experts came out and they started warning people not to plant those wildflower seeds because they contain non-native plants. So when you're going to send one packet of seeds around the entire country, that's going to be a problem because, you know, depending on the region that you're planting in, those plants might not be the correct species for that area. So to speak more with us on this topic, we have a special guest that we're going to call in. Miriam, are you on the line?
I am.
Thank you so much for joining us. This is Miriam Goldberger from Wildflower Farm in Coldwater, Ontario. Thank you for your time today.
I'm happy to be with you.
So we are just getting caught up on the General Mills Free Seeds Initiative, and I wanted to hear your perspective about what you've heard about the seed packets so far, why these are dangerous, and what we can do instead.
Well, let's back up a little bit. I'm a wildflower seed grower. I sell wildflower seeds all over North America. And these are true North American wildflower seeds. But if we look at this exercise that Cheerios has launched, it is a really classic example of greenwashing and unfortunate miseducation. What I mean by that it specifically is the following. I have basically 5 points that are super relevant to this discussion. One, most commercially grown wheat is actually filled with pesticides, and pesticide use is rampant in commercially grown wheat. So,
wow.
And the pesticides actually are a great deal of what kills both the native and non-native pollinators. Point two, native pollinators such as, for example, bumblebees, and there's lots of other kinds of native pollinators, as well as beneficial insects, actually thrive on native plants. And in fact, when you grow wildflowers, you actually grow the native pollinator and beneficial insect community. Why is that so important? Because native pollinators are actually far more efficient and effective in pollinating than the European honeybees, which are the honeybees that most people, the bees that most people are familiar with. But in fact, those are from Europe originally, and they don't actually have the same nutritional needs as native pollinators. And the wildflowers and the native pollinators have evolved for thousands of years together, and they work in a synchronistic fashion. Point three, the non-natives that are included in the Cheerios quote-unquote wildflower seed mix are basically nutritionally ineffective and not as powerful in terms of their nutrient quality as the North American wildflowers are. It's sort of the equivalent of feeding human beings food that is not really high in nutrition, or even going to the other end of the spectrum, could be considered almost like junk food.
Wow.
Yeah. And then my fourth point is that, as I was saying earlier, native plants grow pollinators and beneficial bugs. And there have been studies that have proven that farmers that plant wildflower swaths on their farms actually reduce their need to use pesticides by 60 to 80%.
Wow.
And my fifth and final point is that many commercially grown flowers, that is to say wildflowers and other flowers that are from somewhere else originally that we're familiar with, are often commercially grown overseas with rampant pesticide use.
Wow.
Those are my points.
So the wild, the quote-unquote wildflowers are maybe not even being propagated in this country or in this continent?
That is correct.
Wow. That's amazing. So I have a bunch of questions that have come from these facts that you've given us. This is so fascinating. One is, so you said that the honeybees that we're looking to save are not the most important pollinators.
I mean, I'm not against European honeybees. Mm-hmm. I have over 100 hives on mm-hmm. my own property myself, as well as lots of native pollinators. So I'm not a honeybee hater.
Mm-hmm. So, but we should be trying to not only save the honeybees, but also create habitat for the native pollinators.
Yes, okay. It is the most efficient way for us to landscape and to pollinate the food that we eat.
Wow.
What are some examples of native pollinators?
Bumblebees, moths, many different kinds of flies and wasps, and every single North American wildflower has very specific relationships with different wildflowers that have evolved for thousands of years. The most famous one, the poster child of these relationships, is the monarch butterfly and milkweed.
Mm-hmm.
And they have very specific relationships. It's like, you scratch my back, I scratch yours. In other words, listen, if you will come and pollinate me so that I can make babies, then I will, in turn, take care of your baby monarch, i.e. caterpillar, babies, and feed them my special leaves and protect them so that they can grow up big and strong.
Well, very
this
interesting.
Is an exclusive relationship.
Let me ask a question. If someone was going to start a new population or a new hive, are there difference in qualities of the genetics of the native pollinators? Like, I mean, if you just get them, I know in the male, you can get like a queen bee, but is it like with livestock where certain genetics are better than others, certain breeds or certain genetic lines are better or stronger or more adapted to a place than others? Or
yes,
is a honeybee
that is
a honeybee?
Very true. And mm-hmm. part of the large range of issues facing European honeybees is that they are forced to be itinerant as well. So there are a lot of different factors, and I am not a European honeybee expert, except I can tell you that the way that humans treat them is in some ways, at in certain circumstances, kind of akin to slavery, which doesn't tend to be very healthy.
How can you raise bees in a way that is less, or is that just a factor that of where we're using them for their honey products? I've seen different like hive designs where there's like a drip design. Do you use any alternative hives for that purpose?
I am not a honeybee expert, but what I can tell you, which is really fairly mind-blowing, is that we are one of the very few places that I'm aware of in North America that has totally healthy hives. We have had no losses. Mm. This is probably several specific reasons. One, the bees here receive nutrition of the highest quality. Remember, I was saying much earlier in our conversation that wildflowers offer the highest nutritional content to pollinators and beneficial insects. Mm-hmm. Secondly, we happen to be lucky enough to live in Ontario, Canada, where a lot of pesticides have now been outlawed. And thirdly, our farm just doesn't happen to be near any farm that uses pesticides.
And I have just one last question for you,
sure.
Miriam. I really appreciate all of your thoughts here. So if people in the United States do want to plant wildflower swaths, do want to create pollinator habitat and create honeybee habitat. I saw that you have a seed selector tool on your website to help identify the best flowers to grow in your region. Does that work for the
and
U.S.
we
as well?
We ship wildflowers all over North America.
Great.
On the seed selector tool, you can find the type of soil, the amount of moisture, the amount of sunlight, your state, your province, the bloom time you're interested in, all these factors. We sell individual kinds of wildflowers as well as meadow mixes.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Miriam. I would encourage
Very
everybody to go to wildflowerfarm.com and check out that seed selector tool if you do want to help the native pollinators with native plants. That would be a great source to order your seeds. Thank you for being on the air with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot. Have a great evening.
All right. Thank you so much. And we are going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with a couple more headlines and some interesting stories from our in-studio guests. See you soon.
Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
No, Roberta's.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's the first time I'm hearing that one. That's amazing. We are back. This is the HRN Happy Hour. I'm still smiling from that awesome Roberta's ad. We are here live from our studio inside Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And we have some very special guests in the studio today, including Abe Shaw, who will be joining us soon for some utensil trivia. And before that, I would like to pass the mic over to Emily Pontecorvo. She's on our amazing intern team. She produced our episode today, and she's got a few more headlines and some exciting highlights from a field trip today.
Okay, so the first thing that's going on is that we're going to talk about beef. Americans are eating way less beef. In a study conducted by the Natural Resources Defense Council, they found that Americans cut beef consumption by 19% from 2005 to 2014. So this is nearly a one-fifth reduction, and it's pretty shocking. The New York Times reported on Tuesday about this story, and they had some sources attributing this to a reduction, to high beef prices, and other sources saying that consumers were paying more attention to health and how, you know, their food choices affect their well-being.
Patrick, have you seen this?
Well, you know who predicted this first, that old lady's on the Wendy's commercial.
Where's the beef?
But no, I mean, I think things go up and down, and I think, I don't know. It'd be interesting to see if that's a cyclical thing that'll swing back in a different direction, or if, like, you know, or maybe, you know, even McDonald's, like, I know their breakfast. So beef consumption might be dipping, but their breakfast business is booming. So are people just eating other commodity meats and it's going to swing back? Who knows? It'd be interesting to tell. We haven't noticed much, but, you know, we're not really in the beef business. We're in the pork and turkey business. So.
Well, anyway, the NRDC is hailing this as a victory for the fight against climate change. They see cattle farming as a huge source of greenhouse gases. And that's that story. But in other bovine news, cows are burning to death en masse in these horrible wildfires that are happening in the Southwest. I don't know if you guys have been following this story, but basically 2 million acres, or more than 2 million acres of rangeland across Oklahoma, Kansas, Texas, and Colorado have been burning out the past couple of weeks. Some farmers have lost more than 500 cows, and these are animals that sell for nearly $2,000 at auction, so this is a lot of money. They're also losing infrastructure like fences and their homes and other, you know, buildings on their farms. And this is happening in the heart of Trump country, and he has not even acknowledged it once. And, you know, he's tweeting about Snoop Dogg and the East Coast blizzard and the press, but he hasn't mentioned what's happening to his people out.
It's horrible.
Out in the Southwest, so. Yeah. And now today, this is very, very recent news, but earlier this morning, I went down to La Casita Verde, which is a community garden in Williamsburg, where Catherine Garcia, who's the commissioner of the Department of Sanitation, announced a new expansion of the Organis Collection Service in New York City. So I don't know if you guys know this, but New York City currently has the biggest organics collection program in the country, meaning we divert the most food waste from our landfills more than any place in the country. Nice. And as part of the Zero X30 initiative from Mayor de Blasio, we're trying to send zero waste to landfills by 2030. So program is growing. And Catherine Garcia announced this expansion today. So, David, you have the tape.
We currently serve just shy of 1 million people at the curbside. And with our rollout starting in May of this year and through the fall, we will take that to over 3.3 million people served by Organics Collection. So we're coming to a neighborhood near you, whether that's Williamsburg, Gravesend, Coney Island, Sheepshead Bay, Brownsville, Fort Greene, Brooklyn Heights. So really, it spreads the gamut of all of the different diverse neighborhoods of the city. And we know that your food waste can be either an energy source or can become compost, as we see here. So we are expanding our network. We will be coming once a week to collect organics at the curb. We will be delivering brown bins to every building in the communities that we'll be serving that are under 9 units. We will be doing a lot of community outreach, and I want to encourage everyone who's involved in their communities to be on the lookout for our tabling events, to be on the lookout for when we are doing civic meetings, when we are at religious institutions, because we want to engage with everyone on how important this is.
So that was Catherine Garcia, the commissioner of the Department of Sanitation in New York City. And as far as getting engaged, if you do live in a building with 10 or more units, you can still be served by the Organics Collection Program. You just need to reach out to DSNY. You can go to their website and submit an application and just click on Zero Waste on the Department of Sanitation website.
Can I just say, I lived in a Brooklyn neighborhood that was part of the pilot program for that. It's mind-boggling how many pounds of material, you know, can be collected in a week. And you can drop off at a lot of the green markets, a lot of the green market, farmers markets. It's having grown up outside of the city and in a non-urban area, it's so neat to see so much collection happening where nobody would expect it.
That's awesome. Do you guys have composting in the buildings where you live?
Well, they don't allow it.
My building just got it. I live in Stuytown. And we just got organic collection like maybe 2 months ago. We used to keep it. I would collect it and keep it in a bag in the freezer, which like my freezer is so small. It was horrible. But I would take it to the green market like whenever I could or was around on the weekend and drop it off. But now that we have it in the building, it's awesome. And I find like that really most of the garbage that we generate in my house is like in the kitchen. Mostly I don't consume a lot other than food, and I do consume a lot of food, and I would say it's like 50-50, like what can be garbage or recycling versus what can be composted. And so we're thrilled because it's just been like so cool to see like everybody in the building's doing it. I just got a little matching trash can. They both go like inside my kitchen cupboard door, so I have like trash on the left and compost on the right, and it's 50-50, and it's so cool, and everyone's happy about it. I didn't know, because I grew up in a hippie family, where like always like really excited about compost. I didn't know how like the general population of my building would take it, but
people seem really thrilled. So I'm so happy to see that it's expanding and becoming more of like a municipal operation than kind of like a special niche thing that some buildings are doing.
I didn't know you were a hippie.
Yeah.
Wow. They make some very stylish indoor compost bins.
True.
Mm.
Some pretty ones.
It's if cool. you build it, they will compost.
That's right.
Thank you, David.
David, do you have compost?
Yeah, we will like stick it in. We just like make up a little bag of our own, stick it in the freezer, and then take it down to the farmer's market on Cortell U on the weekend.
So responsible.
Thank you,
guys.
Thank you.
You know,
I do what I can.
So yeah, it's one of those things like you can't get too complacent and think like, oh, I'm doing this great job because I'm composting. Like I still use a lot of grocery and meal delivery services that generate a ton of plastic and paper and like other just like non-recyclable garbage. And so I do have a lot of guilt around that. But the composting is just one small way that we're going to be able to reduce waste. And I'm really optimistic for when companies like Fresh Direct or like Blue Apron are going to be able to start using maybe reusable containers. I think this is my vision for the future, and then we'll move on. I think that once everything is delivered by a drone, it'll be a lot easier to have like a reusable plastic crate that could be dropped off and then just like sanitized in a giant dishwasher kind of machine to deliver groceries and meal kits so that it's not like so many cardboard boxes and coolers and everything.
Mm. Very Jetsons.
Also, not reproducing is a big thing we can do.
Okay, David. Davey Downer in the
and
booth.
I'm sure all, sure though. Do all the drones become compost after it, after they reach a certain age?
I thought you were going to say, do they become self-aware and to take over?
Yeah, they end up in the drone zone.
They could just refuse to bring us our food and then take over the world.
Yeah, right.
A slow death.
Oh, no.
So, Abe.
What's up, Abe?
Past, present, and future. Can you tell everybody a little bit about eatingtools.com? What is Eating Tools? You've been doing this for a long time.
Yeah. But it's, I can say it's a lifelong endeavor. Eating Tools has been around for about 3 years, though. I mean, I've worked in restaurants, front of the house, back of the house. You know, I obviously have a love for good food and good drink. And I worked in and around knives, custom knives, handmade, like beautiful, collectible, oftentimes over-the-top knives. And doing that, I met these craftsmen. I met these makers, these just incredible people with passion for, like, you know, not just the processes and you know, their creative vision, but for the, you know, the materials and the metallurgy and the science behind what they were doing. And I realized there's this little niche knife world that I was seeing all these things in. These tools had never seen the light of day outside of that world. Chopsticks. You see, I have a thing for chopsticks. I grew up eating with chopsticks. My mom, I mean, from when I was, you know, a tiny kid, ate everything under the sun with chopsticks. You know, one kernel of popcorn at a time, salad, whatever it might have been. You know, it was chopsticks. I buy her chopsticks as gifts now. Chopsticks was one of the early ones, these titanium chopsticks. A buddy of mine was making these. They're beautiful, and they would sell out at knife shows. And nobody, like, in the culinary world, the people that I felt would really appreciate them, you know, knew that they existed. And so, long story short, I launched Eating Tools.
So, on Eating Tools, speaking of the titanium chopsticks, you have some really cool... would you call that anodized, or how do you get the rainbow of colors on those chopsticks?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. Those are anodized. They are electrochemically anodized in a liquid solution. And part of what's neat, titanium is like an ultimate culinary material. It doesn't rust or corrode. It's really lightweight, but it's incredibly strong. It's non-magnetic. It doesn't conduct heat well. And one of the things you can do to titanium, like aluminum, but only more vibrantly, is anodize it. And you're actually changing the molecular... sort of makeup of the top layer of atoms to reflect different shades of light. And so depending on the voltage that you submerge these in the liquid, you get different colors. And so it's not a coating, you know, there's nothing, you know, unsafe about it. Mm-hmm. And it actually makes it stronger. So it's one of those kind of cool, you know, stylistic, form and function kind of a thing you can do to an eating tool like that.
And are they're dishwasher safe and everything?
They're dishwasher safe, yeah. So yeah. Cool. I would, as a disclaimer, you know, I'd hate to think that most of the things I sell ever see the inside of a dishwasher. but you have my blessing to dishwash titanium chopsticks.
That does tend to be one of my criteria for kitchen tools. But you also have a lot of really beautiful handmade and one-of-a-kind items. What are some of the things that you're selling on the site that you feel really are unique and beautiful that people should know about?
I mean, I'd have to say chef knives. Chef knives have this allure in kitchens and with chefs. That means that the people that buy them tend to be looking for, you know, specific things, tend to kind of know what they want. You know, chefs describe their knife as an extension of their hand. Chefs have these intimate relationships with their knives. You know, they keep them in these fancy leather bags and they make sure that nobody else in the kitchen can touch them. And that also means that the people that are making them oftentimes come from a place of almost extreme passion and enthusiasm for whatever it is that you know they're doing, whatever makes their work unique. Mm-hmm. So to work with the guys and gals that I work with that make knives, some of them are right here in Brooklyn. I mean, it's always a blast to work with local artists. Some of them are off. I was in France last summer with an artist who, you know, has his focus, and it's all about water-quenching carbon steel, something that almost nobody will touch, and it lends itself to this edge performance and knife geometry that all of a sudden I've gotten into. You know, I'm not a formally trained chef, and I'm not a knife maker, but I just get kicks out of being around people that take what they do that seriously and in that kind of way.
Has there ever been anything you've seen, a tool that didn't exist, and you're like, I gotta invent something that serves this purpose, like tongs with the beer holder, or that's something because I'm not creative, but you know, or chopsticks that have this, or you know, I don't know.
It's a good question. Well, speaking of not being creative, you know, one thing I always tell my artists when we're talking about a new project is, listen, you're the creative, you know, mind behind this. You do what you think is best. So, you know, I haven't really conceptualized a new tool, but working with the artist to, you know, to tweak and to refine and to play with mixes of materials. To be honest, I'm more into that mix of design, style, and function rather than groundbreaking new developments.
Mm-hmm. One so day. I have a question from the audience. My boyfriend's texting me. He's maybe the only person listening to us right now, but he wants to ask.
He's one of thousands.
Where yes. Promote the network?
Hey Will,
you sound like me.
Hey Will,
hi boyfriend.
Hey Will. Hey.
So he wants to know because as soon as you started talking about knives, he was just like knives. Yes. He wants to know when you're looking for a knife to use, what do you look for?
Oh man, it's such a personal thing. You know, I tell people, you know, I sell these like expensive handmade knives, and listen, at the end of the day, they're all going to cut. They're all going to slice. They're all going to chop. They're all going to julienne and dice and everything else. You know, I look for a knife that feels right in my hand. I mean, you know, just like they're all going to cut, you know, knives of this caliber, they should all be balanced. They should all be fairly comfortable. You know, I'm looking for the knife that speaks to me. I mean, this is a tool that's going to prepare like my family and my sustenance. You know, I'm going to use it with my family. I'm going to... It really is. It's this personal thing that eventually I'm probably going to pass down to my son. You know, there's no reason that these knives shouldn't last like generations. Mm-hmm. So yeah. That's what I'm thinking of when I go to pick up a knife.
Would you say the knife finds you?
It's a good question. I have heard knife speak. I won't talk about when that was.
Abe Shaw, the Ollivander of knives.
This kind of leads into my question, Abe. I'm just curious, like, how are your knife skills personally? You're not a trained chef per se, or like, are you a super, are you fruit ninja? Are you like the julienne master?
I can move pretty quickly. I consider my skills, you know, pretty solid until I set up that camera and I try to shoot that quick video for like an Instagram, and You may have noticed I've never posted an Instagram of myself chopping, so maybe that answers that question.
But I think almost Instagram level is probably pretty exquisite knife skills that I'm guessing you're pretty good.
A couple tricks up my sleeve.
All right. Well, we would like to...
A couple knives up there, too.
Yeah. Let's see. Next. Are you packing?
No, I'm not. I have chopsticks in my coat out there.
I think that counts.
So how are people going to buy his stuff? I mean, where do they go? How do they do it? How does it work?
EatingTools.com. What's your Instagram?
EatingTools.com. EatingTools on Instagram. Eating Tools on Facebook.
On the Heritage Radio Network partners page.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Of course.
That's right. Proud to be here.
That's how most people will access you.
Yes.
Jordan and Claire from The Office came up with a game yesterday for you. Just for you.
Outstanding.
It's going to be real.
So we thought, okay, we have a utensil expert coming into the studio. How often does that happen? I mean, you know, I'm sure there are legions of utensil experts, but I think that you are among the first and foremost, and we wanted to test your knowledge.
It's an honor.
Kat, do you want to start us off with the first question?
Okay, so question one. This is, how many combinations of spoon, fork, and knife can you name? So, spork, I'll give you spork. That's the one that exists, but can you name any other hybrids?
Spoon, fork, and knife.
Or invent them on the spot.
Or just like invent them.
You know, so many include, there's the chong, chopsticks, and tongs. There's the chork, chopsticks, and fork.
Yeah.
We've covered the spork. I'm going to have to do the nork. Which
ding,
is
ding, ding.
The,
got it.
The name actually of a flatware company, but
really,
yeah, yeah, and they do some neat stuff.
Oh, wow,
the plune,
the plune,
and the ladle, spoon and the ladle, spoon and the ladle.
You got any more? We have three more on our list.
Spoon, oh, really?
Fork and knife.
Spoon, fork, and knife.
Spife, obviously, the spife. You gotta have a spork with a little spoon with a serrated edge. And then there's gonna be the nork.
We got the nork already.
We got the nork?
Yeah. Two more.
I guess the nork and the fife are the same thing.
Oh, fife? We don't have fife on the list.
Fife.
What kind of operation is
it's
this?
It's a musical utensil.
Well, yeah, we're here to learn, instrument? And we are learning. Okay.
Wait, now you've got to give me the last one.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Are you sure you can't name any more?
Hasn't this man done enough?
Well, here, listen.
Is it made by eating tools?
You said spife already.
Yeah, all right,
okay, hold on. But this is remarkable because we had five on our list. You have given us an additional five, you and Patrick together, that we didn't even have.
Yeah.
So we do have two more, but you have put us to shame in our question
development. Yeah, your research team, I don't know.
Well, technically some of them are kind of, well, we'll get to this.
Can we trade?
Two more.
Have two of my five and you give
knife,
me
fork, and spoon. Are you tapped out?
All right, give it to us.
Yeah, you better lay it on me.
We have the spoorf, which is a knife, fork, and spoon.
I like
spoorf.
It.
Spoorf. Also, like it. The splayed. Same combo.
Splayed. Oh.
Splayed.
That one, I... All right, I have to find a splayed artist.
I don't understand splayed.
So technically, you brought to our attention the fife, the chong, the chork, the plune, and the pladle. But technically, the question was combinations of spoon, fork, and knife.
Yeah, I like Abe's better.
I was pushing it.
Yeah, but I really like the chong and the chork.
And the chong. Chong.
Well, the splorf, I think,
about the
exists.
Good one.
You were saying about the splorf?
The splorf, there's the Light My Fire titanium spork is really a splorf. It's a fork with a little serrated edge on one of the tines and then a spoon on the other end.
So
it's
did you know that you can be the proud owner of a splorf if you go to eatingtools.com?
That's right. Anodized and all.
Splorf. Trife? Trident and the knife?
Or when you're eating
spoon,
underwater.
Fork, and knife. Spoon, fork, and knife.
I'm sorry.
Okay, ready for the next question?
Go.
Okay, so I'm going to name something and give you a description, and you tell me if it's a real utensil or not.
All right.
Okay. First one, trongs, plastic finger protectors designed to keep your fingers clean while eating chicken wings and ribs.
Real. Absolutely real.
Nailed it.
That's correct.
Wow, good. That was confident.
All right. Watchula.
Have you used those before?
I've seen them. I've seen them.
In use?
In advertisements, anyways.
Okay, the Watchula, a spatula with a built-in timer set to tell you when to flip pancakes.
I can't endorse that.
No, it's too short-term. You have to be able to do that on your own. False. I agree with him.
All right.
Patrick, you're cheating.
Correct.
I'm not cheating. I'm not reading
this. Don't look at your script.
Okay, don't look. Don't look.
I haven't looked at an outline since I started radio. Why do you think my show was so bad?
Okay. This one is called The Fred. It's a combination can opener, bottle opener, tiny spoon. It was issued to the Australian Defense Force soldiers, and it stands for the Field Ration Eating Device, but they jokingly called it the fucking ridiculous eating device.
It's amazing, and I fucking need one.
Fake or real?
Real.
It yes. is real.
That was just too detailed to be fake.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, last one is...
Issued between 1923 and 1924 only.
Yeah, probably. Okay, the Frisk, a small whisk that you put on your finger like a finger puppet.
It should be real, but it's not.
It's not real.
Oh,
right.
You're good.
He wow. knows his utensils.
He does.
He knows what's up.
He knows.
Okay, okay, next
you're
question.
You're 4 for 4 on that one.
Yeah, killing it. Okay, question number 3. Who is credited for bringing the fork to France and making it a common utensil in Europe?
I know this answer, but I won't say it.
Because you have the script.
I never read the script. Why do you think I'm so bad?
I knew
bad?
The answer to this once upon a time. It's not going to come to me.
She was a queen, and she moved north because of a marriage, and she brought all Italian culture with her.
Wow.
Italian, that's a big clue.
Oh, wow.
Catherine de' Medici.
That's
she
right.
She also used nice. Big parties as a political tool to entice and seduce her allies, mm-hmm. not to conquer her,
and,
not to attack. She
and
was very
she
powerful.
May have also poisoned her husband.
Yeah.
You know how I know a lot about Catherine de' Medici? This is going to be an embarrassing fact
Medici.
About myself. Medici. Mm-hmm. This is going to be embarrassing. You wanted me to reveal some more about my personality, Patrick.
Yes.
I'm going to reveal. I watched that garbage show on the CW called Rain. It's like Vampire Diaries, but about like...
What?
Yeah. Oh,
I've
yeah.
Never heard. Of is it current? I've never.
It's
heard of
pretty
it.
Current, and it's like It's like the, it's along the lines of like Vampire Diaries.
Wait, it rained like REIGN.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like a teen dramedy about like Catherine de Medici and Mary Queen of Scots, and like, but you actually learn some history.
They were
it's
great
pretty
patrons,
bad though.
Great patrons of the arts. Like if
yes.
someone's very good to heritage or the radio, I always say they're a Medici because you know they help these families.
You're so Italian.
And now I won't forget this. She didn't stab her husband with a
I was going to say
poisoned.
Yeah,
yeah. It all comes back to food somehow.
But anyway, it's a brilliant political.
Oh, way! Oh, hey!
Her monarchy was bankrupt, so she would throw huge 3-week-long parties, and all the other people, heads of states, would be like, we're not going to conquer her.
Queen
it was very
Leather.
Smart.
Can yep. we read the list of other things she was credited for bringing to France?
Oh, yeah. You
it's
wanna,
amazing.
You want me to do it?
Yeah.
Okay. She was also. Credited for bringing olive oil, Chianti, white beans, artichokes, aspics, baby peas, broccoli, cakes, candied vegetables, cream puffs, custard, ices, lettuce, milk-fed veal, melon seeds, parsley, pasta, puff pastry, quenelle?
Quenelles. Those cinnamon pastries.
Scallopini, sherbet, spinach, sweetbreads, truffles, and... How do you say that one, Patrick?
Zabaglione.
Hey,
but you know.
But what else is there? That
that's a lot.
What
to
did
bring.
They have before?
Before they ate.
Well,
actually, all of this is widely disputed, except for the fork.
Oh,
it is disputed.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Italy was being where it was in the middle of the Mediterranean. Every culture came through there and conquered it and all that. Meanwhile, France, you know, through the way geography is, was kind of removed. And England, through the mountain range, was either further removed. So that was the last of the European countries to benefit from all the mm-hmm. the Renaissance that Italy went through maybe 3 centuries before.
And when Mary Queen of Scots went back to Scotland, she really, I don't think she took much with her. Not like Catherine brought from Italy.
Right, right, right.
She was kind of exiled.
She was exiled and
yeah.
killed.
I know so much from watching the CW. Guys, it's basically the new History Channel.
That's
really.
Good.
Yeah.
This is a spinoff show. I sense it. History from
okay.
CW.
We have another cat. History question. It goes way, way back into the Wayback Machine.
Oh, okay. What is older, the spoon or chopsticks?
Spoon.
Yeah.
You just knew that, wow. Just like that.
Humans have used the spoons since Paleolithic times. They use like shells and chips of wood as spoons.
Yeah, seashells. There's so many natural
scooping
scoops.
Yeah.
Yep.
Couldn't you argue there are many natural chopsticks as well?
Sticks.
You could. Yeah. Yeah.
But I guess it
takes more skills.
A new kind of dexterity.
It takes using different
skills.
Yeah.
Well, and like I think someone told me that oysters may have been like one of the first animals humans ate, and so that's kind of like a natural spoon.
Mm. And one of the only animals that is also its own spoon upon which you eat.
Exactly. There you go.
Oh, interesting.
That may be how they got the idea.
Some of the best foods, they come with their own built-in utensils.
Like what else?
I mean, you know, you can eat the olive meat off of the pit. Mm-hmm. It's a little tougher. I mean, any seafood, though, you were talking lobsters. Mm-hmm. I mean, heck, my little boy sits there with a banana. I mean, you've got, you know, you teach him. You peel
watermelon.
It off, and it's got the handle on the bottom and the meat coming out of the top. Mm-hmm. It's... Yeah.
So I learned a trick.
Yeah.
I actually didn't know this really until maybe last year or 2 years ago. A way of eating mussels. You can usually get the tiny little fork and you like get your moules marinier sauce all over yourself with the tiny fork. But the French way to eat it is you maybe use the tiny fork for the first mussel, but then you use the spent mussel shell as a little tongs and you pluck the mussel out of the next one and feed it to yourself that
Mongs?
Way.
That didn't sound
Mongols.
That didn't sound very hippie, though, getting the moule marnier all over yourself. But it is.
What a first world problem.
Fancy hippie.
But I do want to know, doesn't that imply if oysters were the first food that mankind ate, that mankind was developed on the sea?
Yes.
I always thought it came out of the forest or the central of Africa, but maybe mankind developed on the coast.
The guy who told me that worked at an oyster farm, so they may have been a little bit biased.
Because, you know, pork and turkey were really the first foods.
You guys should have a debate.
Bacon was the first food.
But that was like someone's like first question was like, but didn't humans originate like not
from
on the coast?
Well, I was just seeing something about this as the deserts were drying and they were getting driven towards the coasts. All of a sudden, they ended up where there was this entirely new, buffet of foods that they'd never seen, and oysters were right on the top. I mean, they've always been incredibly. Abundant. And
that must have been quite a find.
Who's the first guy who's like, let me bang this on a rock?
It might have been a woman.
Could have been a woman. You're right. Because maybe they were gathering.
Okay, guys, we have just
or maybe
time
they were
for
hunting.
One last question. We're almost out of time. Kat, what's the
final question? Who invented the spork?
Who's the stumper?
Pass.
James Beard?
His name was Samuel W. Francis, and he issued that patent in February of 1874.
That's like a trivia pursuit question. No one could possibly
know
the
answer.
Oh, no,
that was overly hard.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we knew that we would have
a tough
customer here.
I'm doing more homework before I come in.
Abe, thanks so much for letting us grill you today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to the HRN Happy Hour. We're on every Thursday at 5 o'clock. Thank you so much to our in-studio guest, Abe Shaw, from Eating Tools, eatingtools.com. Thanks for coming out today.
You guys are awesome. Support HRN, people.
Yeah.
Thank you. Our founder, Patrick Martins.
Thanks
Thank
for
you.
Having me again.
Thanks for being here. Our producer, Emily Pontecorvo. Yay. Kat Johnson, Communications Director.
Bye.
Yeah. And our fabulous studio engineer, David Tadashore. Thank you. Yeah, air horn for you. Once again, we'll be back next Thursday, 5 o'clock.
We won't be back next Thursday. We're taking a break.
We're taking a break next Thursday. We'll see you in 2 Thursdays, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks a lot for being with us.
Nice.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.